This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Hiding Place by C.J. Tudor. Read for you by Richard Armitage. Prologue. Even before stepping into the cottage, Gary knows that this is bad. It's a sickly sweet smell drifting out through the open door, the flies buzzing around the sticky hot hallway. And if that isn't a dead giveaway that something about this house is not right in the worst possible way, then the silence confirms it. A smart white Fiat sits in the driveway. A bike is propped outside the front door. Wellies discarded just inside. A family home. And even when a family home is empty, it has an echo of life. It shouldn't sit, heavy and foreboding, with a thick, suffocating blanket of silence like this house does. Still, he calls again. Hello? Anyone here? Cheryl raises a hand and raps briskly against the open door. Shut when they arrived, but unlocked. Again, not right. Arnhill might be a small village, but people still lock their doors. Police! She shouts. Nothing. Not a faint footstep, creak, or whisper. Gary sighs, realizing he feels superstitiously reluctant about entering, not just because of the rancid aroma of death. There's something else, something primal, that seems to be urging him to turn and walk away, right now. Sarge? Cheryl looks up at him, one pencil-thin eyebrow raised questioningly. He glances at his 5'4", barely breaking 100 pounds companion. At over 6 foot and almost 20 stone, Gary is the Baloo to Cheryl's delicate Bambi, at least in looks. Personality-wise, suffice it to say, Gary cries at Disney movies. He gives her a small, grim nod, and the pair step inside. The ripe, rich smell of human decay is overwhelming. Gary swallows, trying to breathe through his mouth, wishing fervently that someone else, anyone else, could have taken this call. Cheryl pulls a disgusted face and covers her nose with her hand. These small cottages are fairly typical in layout. Small hallway, stairs to the left, living room to the right, and a tiny kitchen tacked on the back. Gary turns towards the living room, pushes open the door. Gary has seen dead bodies before. A young kid killed by a hit-and-run driver, a teenager mangled in farm equipment. They were horrible, yes. Needless, most definitely. But this... this is bad, he thinks again. Really bad. Fuck, Cheryl whispers. And Gary couldn't have put it better himself. Everything conveyed in that single, appalled expletive. Fuck. A woman is slumped on a worn leather sofa in the middle of the room, facing a large flat-screen TV. The TV has a spiderweb crack in its front around which dozens of fat blue bottles crawl lazily. The rest buzz around the woman. The body, Gary corrects himself. Not a person anymore, just a corpse. Just another case. Pull it together. Despite the bloating of putrefaction, he can tell that in life she had probably been slim, with pale skin now mottled and marbled with green veins. She is dressed well, checked shirt, fitted jeans and leather boots. Telling her age is difficult, mainly because most of the top of her head is missing. Well, not exactly missing. He can see chunks of it stuck to the wall and the bookcase and the cushions. Not much doubt about who pulled the trigger. The shotgun still rests in her lap, bloated fingers bulging around it. Quickly, Gary assesses what must have happened. Gun inserted into her mouth, pulls the trigger, bullet exits slightly to the left, as that's where the worst damage is, which makes sense, as the gun is in her right hand. Gary is only a uniformed sergeant, and doesn't have a lot to do with forensics, but he does watch a lot of CSI. Decomposition probably occurred quite rapidly, It's hot in the little cottage. Stifling, in fact. The temperature outside is mid-70s. The windows are shut, and although the curtains are pulled, it must be creeping up to 90. He can already feel the sweat trickling down his back and dampening his underarms. Cheryl, who never loses her cool, is wiping her forehead and looking uncomfortable. Shit. What a mess, she says, with a weariness he doesn't often hear. She stares at the body on the sofa, shaking her head. Then her eyes shift around the rest of the room, lips pursed, face grim. Gary knows what she is thinking. Nice cottage, nice car, nice clothes, but you never really know. You never really know what goes on inside. Apart from the leather sofa, the only other furniture is a heavy oak bookcase, a small coffee table, and the TV. He looks at it again, wondering about the crack in the screen and why the flies are so interested in crawling all over it. He takes a few steps forward, broken glass crunching beneath his feet, and bends down. Closer, he spots the reason. The splintered glass is covered in dark, crusted blood. More has run down the screen to the floor where, he realizes, he has only just avoided standing in a sticky puddle that has spread over the floorboards. Cheryl moves to stand beside him. What's that? Blood. He thinks about the bike. The Wellingtons. The silence. We need to check the rest of the cottage, he says. She looks at him with troubled eyes and nods. The stairs are steep, creaky, and streaked with more trails of dark blood. At the top, a narrow landing leads to two bedrooms and a tiny bathroom. If possible, the heat on the landing is more intense, the smell even more repugnant. Gary gestures for Cheryl to go and check the bathroom. For a moment, he thinks she'll argue. It's obvious that the smell is coming from one of the bedrooms, but for once, she lets him play the senior officer and walks cautiously across the landing. He faces the first bedroom door, a bitter metallic taste in his mouth, and then, slowly, eases it open. It's a woman's room. Clean, neat, and empty. Wardrobe in one corner, chest of drawers by the window, large bed covered with a pristine cream duvet. On the bedside table, a lamp and a solitary picture in a plain wooden frame. He walks over and picks it up. A young boy, 10 or 11, small and wiry, with a toothy smile and messy blonde hair. Oh, God, he finds himself praying. Please, God, no. With an even heavier heart, he walks back out into the corridor to find Cheryl looking pale and tense. Bathroom's empty, she says, and he knows that she is thinking the same thing. Only one room left. Only one door to open to reveal the grand prize. He angrily swats away a fly and would have taken a steadying breath if the smell hadn't already been choking him. Instead, he reaches for the handle and pushes the door open. Cheryl is too tough to be sick, but he still hears her make a retching noise. His own stomach gives a good solid heave, but he manages to fight the nausea back down. When he thought this was bad, he was wrong. This is a fucking nightmare. The boy lies on his bed, dressed in an oversized T-shirt, baggy shorts and white sports socks. The elastic of the socks digs into the swollen flesh of his legs. Bright white socks, Gary can't help noticing, blindingly white, fresh on white, like a detergent ad. Or perhaps they just seem that way because everything else is red. Dark red. Streaking the oversized T-shirt, smeared all over the pillows and sheets. And where the boy's face should be, just a big, mushy mess of red. Features indiscernible, crawling with busy black bodies, flies and beetles, wriggling in and out of the ruined flesh. His mind flicks back to the splintered TV screen and the puddle of blood on the floor, and suddenly he sees it. the boy's head being smashed into the TV again and again, then hammered into the floor until he is unrecognizable, until he has no face. And maybe that was the point, he thinks, as he raises his eyes to the other red, the most obvious red, the red it is impossible to miss. Big letters scrawled across the wall above the boy's body. Not my son.
1. Never go back. That's what people always tell you. Things will have changed. They won't be the way you remembered. Leave the past in the past. Of course, the last one is easier said than done. The past has a habit of repeating on you, like a bad curry. I don't want to go back, really. There are several things higher up on my wish list, like being eaten alive by rats or line dancing. This is how badly I don't want to see the crap hole I grew up in ever again. But sometimes there is no choice except the wrong choice. That's why I find myself driving along a winding A road through the North Nottinghamshire countryside at barely 7 o'clock in the morning. I haven't seen this road for a long time. Come to think of it, I haven't seen 7 a.m. for a long time. The road is quiet. Only a couple of cars overtake me, one blaring its horn, no doubt the driver indicating that I'm impeding his Lewis Hamilton-esque progress to whatever shitty job he simply must get to a few minutes sooner. To be fair to him, I do drive slowly. Nose to the windscreen, hands gripping the steering wheel with white peaked knuckles, slowly. I don't like driving. I try not to whenever possible. I walk or take buses or trains for longer journeys. Unfortunately, Arnhill is not on any main bus routes, and the nearest train station is 12 miles away. Driving is the only real option. Again, sometimes you have no choice. I signal and turn off the main road, onto a series of even narrower, more treacherous country lanes. Fields of turgid brown and dirty green sprawl out either side. Pigs snuffle the air from rusted corrugated huts, in between tumble-down copses of silver birch. Sherwood Forest, or what remains of it. The only places you're likely to find Robin Hood and Little John these days are on badly painted signs above run-down pubs. The men inside are usually more merry, and the only thing they'll rob you of is your teeth if you look at them the wrong way. It's not necessarily grim up north. Nottinghamshire is not even that far north, unless you have never left the hellish embrace of the M25. But it is somehow colourless, flat, sapped of the vitality you would expect from the countryside. Like the mines that were once so prevalent here have somehow scooped the life out of the place from within. Finally, a long time since I've seen anything resembling civilization, or even a McDonald's, I pass a crooked and weathered sign on my left. Arnhill welcomes you. Underneath, some eloquent little shit has added, to get fucked. Arnhill is not a welcoming village. It is bitter and brooding and sour. It keeps to itself and views visitors with distrust. It is stoic and steadfast and weary all at the same time. It is the sort of village that glowers at you when you arrive and spits on the ground in disgust as you leave. Apart from a couple of farmhouses and older stone cottages on the outskirts, Arnhill is not quaint or picturesque. Even though the pit closed for good almost 30 years ago, its legacy still runs through the place, like the ore through the earth. There are no thatched roofs or hanging baskets. The only things hanging outside the houses here are lines of washing and the occasional St. George's flag. Rows of uniform, sooty-bricked terraces squat along a main road, along with one tatty pub, the Running Fox. There used to be two more, the Arnhill Arms and the Bull, but they shot a long time ago. Back in the day, my day, the landlord of the Fox, Gypsy, would turn a blind eye to some of us older kids drinking in there. I still remember throwing up 3 pints of snakebite and what felt like most of my guts in the filthy toilet, only to emerge to find him standing there with a mop and bucket. Next door, the Wandering Dragon Takeaway and Chippy is similarly untouched by progress, fresh paint, or, I'm willing to bet, a new menu. One glitch in my total recall. The small corner shop where we used to buy bags of penny chews, flying saucers and wham bars has gone. A Sainsbury's local stands in its place. I suppose not even Arnhill is completely immune to the march of progress. Except for that, my worst fears are confirmed. Nothing has changed. The place is, unfortunately, exactly as I remember it. I drive further along the high street, past the tatty children's play area and small village green. A statue of a miner stands in the centre, a memorial to the pit workers killed in the Arnhill Colliery disaster of 1949. Past the village's highlights, up a small hill, I see the gates to the school. Arnhill Academy, as it's called now. The buildings have been given fresh cladding, the aging English block, where a kid once fell from the very top, has been pulled down, and a new seating area put in its place. You can roll a turd in glitter, but it's still a turd. I should know. I pull into the staff car park around the rear of the building and climb out of my knackered old Golf. There are 2 other cars in parking spaces, a red Corsa and an old Saab. Schools are rarely empty during the summer holidays. Teachers have lesson plans to write up, classroom displays to organise, interventions to supervise, and sometimes interviews to attend. I lock my car and walk around to the front reception, trying not to limp. My leg is hurting today. Partly the driving, partly the stress of being here. Some people get migraines. I get the equivalent in my bad leg. I should use my stick, really. But I hate it. Makes me feel like an invalid. People look at me with pity. I hate being pitied. Pity should be saved for those who deserve it. Wincing slightly, I walk up the steps to the main door. A shiny plaque above them reads, "Good, better, best, never let it rest. Till your good is better, and your better is best." Inspiring stuff. But I can't help thinking of the Homer Simpson alternative. Kids, you tried your best, and you failed miserably. The lesson is, never try. I press the intercom beside the door. It crackles, and I lean forward to speak into it. "I'm here to see Mr. Price." Another crackle, a piercing whine of interference, and then the door buzzes. Rubbing at my ear, I push it open and walk inside. The first thing that hits me is the smell. Every school has its own individual one. In the modern academies, it's disinfectant and screen cleaner. In the fee-paying schools, it's chalk, wooden floors, and money. Arnhill Academy smells of stale burgers, toilet blocks, and hormones. "Hello?" An austere-looking woman with cropped grey hair and spectacles glances up from behind the glass-fronted reception area. Miss Grayson? Surely not. Surely she'd be retired by now. Then I spot it, the protruding brown mole on her chin, still sprouting the same stiff black hair. Christ, it really is her. That must mean, all those years ago when I thought she was ancient as the friggin' dinosaurs, she was only, what, 40? The same age I am now. "I'm here to see Mr. Price," I repeat. "It's Joe." "Mr. Thorne?" I wait for a glimmer of recognition. Nothing. But then it was a long time ago, and she's seen a lot of pupils pass through these doors. I'm not the same skinny little kid in an oversized uniform who would scurry through reception, desperate not to hear her bark their name and rebuke them for an untucked shirt or non-school regulation trainers. Miss Grayson wasn't all bad. I would often see some of the weaker, shy kids in her little office. She would apply plasters to scraped knees if the school nurse wasn't in, let them sit and drink squash while they waited to see a teacher, or help with filing, anything to provide a little relief from the torments of the playground. A small place of sanctuary. She still scared the crap out of me. Still does, I realize. She sighs, in a way that manages to convey I am wasting her time, my time, and the school's time, and reaches for the phone. I wonder why she's here today. She isn't teaching stuff. Although somehow I'm not surprised. As a child, I could never picture Miss Grayson outside of the school. She was part of the structure. Omnipresent. Mr. Price, she barks. I have a Mr. Thorne here to see you. Okay, right, fine. She replaces the receiver. He's just coming. Great, thanks. She turns back to her computer, dismissing me. No offer of a tea or coffee. And right now my every neuron is crying out for a caffeine fix. I perch on a plastic chair, trying not to look like an errant pupil waiting to see the headmaster. My knee throbs. I clasp my hands together on top of it, surreptitiously massaging the joint with my fingers. Through the window, I can see a few kids, out of uniform, messing around by the school gates. They're swigging Red Bull and laughing at something on their smartphones. Deja vu swamps me. I'm 15 years old again, hanging around the same gates, swigging a bottle of Panda Cola and... what did we hunch over and giggle about before smartphones? Copies of smash hits and stolen porn mags, I guess. I turn away and stare down at my boots. The leather is a little scuffed. I should have polished them. I really need a coffee. I almost give in and ask for a damn drink, when I hear the squeak of shoes on polished linoleum, and the double doors to the main corridor swing open.
Joseph Thorne?
I stand. Harry Price is everything I expected, and less. A thin, wrung-out-looking man, somewhere in his mid-50s, in a shapeless suit and slip-on loafers. His hair is sparse and grey, combed back from a face that looks as though it is constantly on the brink of receiving terrible news. An air of weary resignation hangs about him like bad aftershave. He smiles, crooked, nicotine-stained. It reminds me that I haven't had a cigarette since I left Manchester. That, combined with the caffeine craving, makes me want to grind my teeth together until they crumble. Instead, I stick out a hand and manage what I hope is a pleasant smile in return. Good to meet you. I see him quickly appraise me. Taller than him, by a couple of inches. Clean-shaven, good suit, expensive when it was new. Dark hair, although rather more shot through with grey these days. Dark eyes that are rather more shot through with blood. People have told me I have an honest face, which just goes to show how little people know. He grips my hand and shakes it firmly. My office is just this way. I adjust my satchel on my shoulders, try to force my bad leg to walk properly, and follow Harry to his office. Showtime.
So, your letter of recommendation from your previous head is glowing. It should be. I wrote it myself. Thank you. In fact, everything here looks very impressive.
Bullshit is one of my specialities.
But, and there it is. There is quite a long gap since your last position, over 12 months.
I reached for the weak, milky coffee that Miss Grayson eventually slammed on the desk in front of me. I take a sip and try not to grimace.
Yes, well, that was deliberate.
I decided I wanted a sabbatical. I'd been teaching for 15 years, it was time to restock, think about my future, decide where I wanted to go next.
And do you mind me asking what you did on your sabbatical? Your CV is a little vague.
Some private tutoring. Community work. I taught abroad for a while.
Really? Whereabouts?
Botswana.
Botswana? Where the hell did that come from? I don't think I could even point to it on a frigging map. That's very commendable.
And inventive.
It wasn't entirely altruistic.
The weather was better.
We both laugh. And now you want to get back to teaching full time.
I'm ready for the next stage in my career, yes.
So my next question is, why do you want to work here at Arnhill Academy? Based upon your CV, I would have thought you have your pick of schools.
Based on my CV, I should probably have a Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, I say, I'm a local boy. I grew up in Arnhill. I suppose I'd like to give something back to the community.
He looks uncomfortable, shuffles papers on his desk.
You are aware of the circumstances in which this post became available.
I read the news.
And how do you feel about that?
It's tragic. Terrible. But one tragedy shouldn't define a whole school.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
I'm glad I practiced it.
Although, I add, I do appreciate you must all still be very upset. Mrs. Morton was a popular teacher.
I'm sure.
And Ben, well, he was a very promising pupil.
I feel my throat tighten just a little. I've grown good at hardening myself. But for a moment, it gets to me. A life full of promise. But that's all life ever is. A promise, not a guarantee. We like to believe we have our place all set out in the future, but we only have a reservation.
Life can be cancelled at any moment, with no warning, no refund, no matter how far along you are in the journey. Even if you've barely had time to take in the scenery. Like Ben.
Like my sister.
I realize Harry is still talking. Obviously, it's a sensitive situation. Questions have been asked. How could the school not notice that one of their own teachers was mentally unstable? Could pupils have been at risk?
I understand.
I understand. Harry is more worried about his position and his school than poor dead Benjamin Morton, who had his face caved in by the one person in life who should have been there to protect him.
What I'm saying is, I have to be careful who I choose to fill the position.
Parents need to have confidence.
Absolutely. And I completely understand if you have a better candidate.
I'm not saying that.
He hasn't. I'm bloody sure of it. And I'm a good teacher, mostly. The fact is, Arnhill Academy is a shithole. Underperforming, poorly regarded. He knows it, I know it. Getting a decent teacher to work here will be harder than finding a bear that doesn't crap in the woods, especially under the current circumstances.
I decide to push the point. I hope you don't mind me being honest.
Always good to say when you have no intention of being honest.
I know Arnhill Academy has problems. That's why I wanted to work here. I'm not looking for an easy ride. I'm looking for a challenge. I know these kids because I used to be one of them. I know the community. I know who and what I'm dealing with. It doesn't faze me. In fact, I think you'll find very little does.
I can tell I've got him. I'm good in interviews. I know what people want to hear. Most importantly, I know when they're desperate.
Harry sits back in his chair. Well, I don't think there's anything else I need to ask.
Good. Well, it was a pleasure meeting.
Oh, actually, There is just one thing. Oh, for fuck. He smiles. When can you start?
2. 3 weeks later.
It's cold in the cottage. The sort of cold you get with a property that has been shut up and unlived in for some time. The sort of cold that gets into your bones and lingers, even when you pump up the heating to max. It smells, too, of disuse and cheap paint and damp.
The pictures on the website didn't do it justice. They conveyed a shabby kind of chic, a quaint neglect. The reality is rather more careworn and dilapidated. Not that I can afford to be picky. I need to live somewhere. And even in a dump like Arnhill, this cottage is the only thing I can afford. Of course, that isn't the only reason I chose it.
Is everything okay?
I turn to the slick-haired young man hovering in the doorway. Mike Belling from Belling & Co. Letting Agency. Not local. Too well-dressed and well-spoken. I can tell he's itching to get back to his city center office and wipe the cow shit off his shiny black brogues.
It's not quite what I expected.
His smile falters.
Well, as we state in the property's description, it's a traditional cottage, not a lot of mod cons, and it has been empty for some time.
I suppose, I say doubtfully. You said the boiler was in the kitchen? I think I should get the place warmed up. Thanks for showing me in. He continues to linger awkwardly.
There is just one thing, Mr. Thorne.
Yeah?
The check for the deposit.
What about it?
I'm sure it's just a mistake, but we haven't received it yet.
Really? I shake my head.
Oh, the post just gets worse, doesn't it?
Well, this is why we prefer bank transfers. But it's no problem. If you could just...
Of course.
I reach into my jacket pocket and pull out my checkbook. Mike Belling hands me a pen. I lean on the arm of the threadbare sofa and scribble out a check. I rip it out and give it to him. He smiles. He then looks at the check, and the smile snaps off.
This is for £500. The deposit plus the first month's rent is £1,000.
That's right. But now I've actually seen the cottage. I look around and pull a face. Quite frankly, it's a dump. It's cold, it's damp, it smells. You'd be lucky to get squatters. You didn't even have the courtesy to come up here and turn on the heating before I arrived.
I'm afraid this really isn't acceptable.
And get yourself another tenant. Bluff called. I see him hesitate. Never show weakness. Or perhaps you can't. Perhaps no one wants to rent this place because of what happened here. You know, that small murder stroke suicide you failed to mention?
His face tenses, like someone has just stuck a hot poker up his backside.
He swallows.
We're not legally obliged to inform tenants.
No, but morally it might be nice. I smile pleasantly.
Bearing all that in mind, I think a substantial discount on the deposit is the very least you can offer.
His jaw clenches. A small tick flickers by his right eye. He'd like to be rude back to me, maybe even hit me, but he can't, because then he would lose his cozy 20 grand a year plus commission job. And how would he pay for all those nice suits and shiny black brogues?
He folds the check up and slips it back into the folder.
Of course.
No problem.
It doesn't take me long to unpack. I'm not one of those people who accumulate things for the sake of it. I've never understood ornaments, and photographs are fine if you have a family and children, but I have neither. Clothes I wear until they wear out, then replace with identical versions. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule. Two items that I have left until last to remove from my small suitcase. One is a pack of well-worn playing cards. I slip these into my pocket. Some card players carry good luck charms. I never believed in luck, until I started to lose. Then I blamed my luck, the shoes I was wearing, the alignment of the fucking stars, everything, apart from myself. The cards are my reverse talisman, a constant reminder of how badly I screwed up. The other item is bulkier, cocooned in newspaper. I lift her out and place her on the bed, as gently as if she were a real baby. Then I carefully unwrap her. Small, podgy legs stick upwards. Tiny hands are clenched at her side. Shiny blonde hair fans into crumpled curls. Vacant blue eyes stare up at me. Or at least one does. The other rattles around in the socket, staring off at an odd angle, as though it has caught the sight of something more interesting and not bothered to inform its companion. I pick up Annie's doll and sit her on top of the chest of drawers, where she can regard me with her lopsided gaze every day and every night. For the rest of the afternoon and evening, I potter, trying to warm up. My leg bothers me if I sit still for too long. The cold and damp in the cottage aren't helping. The radiators don't seem to be working too well. Probably air in the system somewhere. There's a log burner in the living room, but an extensive search of the cottage and the small shed outside doesn't reveal any logs or kindling. However, it does reveal an old electric heater in one cupboard. I switch it on. The bar's crispy fry a thick layer of dust, and the air fills with the smell of burning. Still, it should throw out a decent amount of heat, if it doesn't electrocute me first. Despite the vague dilapidation, I can tell this was probably a cozy family home once. The bathroom and kitchen are tired but clean. The garden out the back is long and football-friendly, fringed by open countryside. A nice, comfortable, safe place for a young boy to grow up. Except he never did. I don't believe in ghosts. My nan was fond of telling me, "It's not the dead you need to be scared of, love, it's the living." She was almost right. But I do believe you can still feel the echoes of bad things. They imprint on the fabric of our reality, like a footprint in concrete. Whatever made the impression is long gone, but you can never erase the mark it left. Perhaps that's why I haven't gone into his room yet. I feel okay about living in the cottage, but the cottage does not necessarily feel okay. How could it? A terrible thing happened within its walls. And buildings remember. I haven't gone shopping for food, but I'm not hungry. Once the clock slips past 7, I open a bottle of bourbon and pour a quadruple. I can't use my laptop because I haven't sorted out an internet connection yet. For now, there's not much to do but sit and adjust to my new surroundings, trying to ignore the ache in my leg and the faint, familiar itch in my gut. I take the pack of cards out and place it on the coffee table, but I don't open it. That's not what the pack is for. Instead, I listen to some music on my phone while reading a much-hyped thriller that I've already guessed the ending of. Then I stand at the back door and smoke a cigarette, staring out at the overgrown garden. The sky is darker than a pit hole in hell, not a single star piercing the blackness. I'd forgotten what countryside dark is like. Too long living in the city. It never gets properly dark in the city, nor this quiet. The only sounds are my own exhalations and the crinkling of the cigarette filter. I wonder, again, why I really came back. Yes, Arnhill is isolated, a half-forgotten dot on the map. But abroad would have been safer. Thousands of miles between me, my debts, and people who do not take a losing streak kindly. Not when you can't pay. I could have changed my name. Maybe got a job bartending in some shack on a beach, sipping margaritas at sundown. But I chose here, or perhaps here chose me. I don't really believe in fate, but I do believe certain things are hardwired into our genes. We're programmed to act and react in a certain way, and that's what shapes our lives. We're incapable of changing it, just like our eye color or our propensity to freckle in the sun. Or perhaps that is just so much bullshit, and a handy excuse to avoid taking responsibility for my own actions. The fact is, I was always going to come back one day. The email just made the decision easier. It arrived in my inbox almost 2 months ago. Surprising, really, that it didn't get shunted straight into junk. Sender, me1992@hotmail.com. Subject, Annie. I almost deleted it straight away. I'd never heard of the sender. It was probably a troll, someone playing a sick joke. There are some subjects that should remain closed. No good can ever come of opening them. The only sensible thing to do was to delete the message, empty the trash, and forget I ever saw it. That decided, I clicked open. I know what happened to your sister. It's happening again. 3. Parents shouldn't have favorites. Another stupid thing people say. Of course parents have favorites. It's human nature. Right back to the time when not all your young would survive. You favored the stronger chick. No point getting attached to the one who might not make it. And let's face it, some children are just easier to love. Annie was our parents' favorite. It was understandable. She was born when I was 7. My cute toddler phase was long behind me. I had grown into a serious, skinny little boy with permanently scabbed knees and dirty shorts. I didn't look sweet anymore. I didn't even make up for it by enjoying a kickabout with a football in the park, or wanting to go and watch Forrest with my dad. I'd rather stay in and read comics or play computer games. This disappointed my dad and annoyed my mum. "Get outside and get some bloody fresh air," she'd scowl at me. Even at 7, I felt fresh air was overrated. But I would reluctantly oblige and inevitably end up falling over or into or onto something, come home filthy and get yelled at all over again. No wonder my parents hankered for another child. A sweet little girl they could dress in pink and lace and cuddle without her frowning and squirming away. I didn't realize back then that my parents had been trying for another baby for a while. A little brother or sister for me. Like it was some sort of special gift or favor they were bestowing. I wasn't too sure I needed a brother or sister. My parents already had me. Another child seemed, in my opinion, surplus to requirements. I remained unconvinced after Annie was born. A strange, shrunken pink blob, her face all kind of squished and alien-looking. All she seemed to do was sleep, shit, or cry. Her high-pitched wails kept me awake at night, staring at the ceiling, wishing my parents had bought me a dog or even a goldfish. I continued in a state of apathy for the first few months, neither loving nor disliking my baby sister that much. When she gurgled at me or clutched my finger until it felt like it was turning blue, I remained unmoved, even as my mum cooed in delight and screeched at my dad to get the bloody camera, Sean! If Annie crawled after me or touched my stuff, I would walk faster or snatch my things back. I wasn't unkind, just disinterested. I hadn't asked for her, so I didn't see why I had to pay her any attention. This continued until she was about 12 months old. Just before her first birthday, she started to walk and babble things that almost sounded like words. Suddenly, she seemed more like a small person rather than a baby. more interesting. Amusing, even, with her foreign-sounding gibberish and wobbly old man steps. I began to play with her and talk to her a little. When she began to mimic me back, an odd feeling swelled in my chest. When she gazed at me and gabbled, "Joey, Joey!" my stomach glowed with warmth. She started to follow me everywhere, copy everything I did, laugh at my silly faces, listen intently when I told her things she couldn't possibly understand. When she was crying, one touch from me and she would stop, so eager to please her big brother that all her other woes were instantly forgotten. I had never been loved in such a way before. Not even by Mum and Dad. They loved me, of course, but they didn't look at me with the same unabashed adoration as my little sister did. No one did. I was more used to being looked at with pity or scorn. I wasn't a little boy with many friends. I wasn't shy, exactly. One of my teachers at my junior school told my parents I was standoffish. I guess I just found other little boys with their dull pursuits like climbing trees and fighting a bit boring and stupid. Besides, I was perfectly happy being on my own. Until Annie came along. For my sister's third birthday, I saved up my pocket money and bought her a doll. It wasn't one of the expensive ones you could buy in the toy shop, the ones that made noises and peed themselves. It was what my dad would call a knockoff from the market. It was actually a bit ugly and creepy, with its hard, blue-eyed stare and odd pursed lips. But Annie loved that doll. She took it everywhere with her and cuddled it to sleep every night. For some reason, probably a name misheard, she called it Abby Eyes. By the time Annie was 5, Abby Eyes had become consigned to a shelf in Annie's room, replaced in favour by Barbie and My Little Pony. But if Mum ever suggested taking her to the jumble sale, Annie would snatch her back with a cry of horror and hold her so tight I was surprised those blue plastic eyes didn't pop right out of their sockets. Annie and I remained close as we grew older. We read together, played cards or computer games on my second-hand Sega Mega Drive. On rainy Sunday afternoons when Dad was down the pub and Mum was busy ironing, the air full of static warmth and the smell of fabric softener, we'd curl up on a beanbag and watch old videos together. E.T., Ghostbusters, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Sometimes a few newer, more grown-up ones Annie probably shouldn't have been watching, like Terminator 2 and Total Recall. Dad had a mate who pirated them and sold them for 50p. The picture was a bit fuzzy, and sometimes you couldn't always make out the actor's words, but as Dad was fond of saying, "Beggars can't be choosers," and "You don't look a gift horse in the mouth." I knew Mum and Dad didn't have a lot of money. Dad used to work down the pit, but after the strike, even though they didn't close our pit straight away, he left. He'd been one of the miners who didn't walk out. He never spoke about it, but I knew the bad feeling, the tension and fights, co-worker against co-worker, neighbour against neighbour, had been too much. I was pretty young when it all happened, but I remember Mum scrubbing the word scab off our front door. Once, someone threw a brick through our window when we were inside watching telly. The next night, Dad went out with some of his mates. When he came back, he had a cut on his lip and looked all messed up. "It's taken care of," he said to Mum, in a hard, grim voice I'd never heard before. Dad changed after the strike. He'd always been, in my eyes, a giant of a man, burly and tall, with a shock of thick, curly, dark hair. Afterwards, he seemed to shrink, become thinner, more stooped. When he smiled, which he did less and less often, the lines at the corner of his eyes sliced deeper into his skin. Grey started to shoot through his hair at the temples. He decided to leave the pit and retrain as a bus driver, I don't think he really liked his new job. It paid a decent enough wage, but not as much as he had earned down the pit. He and Mom argued more, usually about how much she was spending or how he didn't realize what a growing family cost to feed and clothe. That was when he'd go off down the pub. He only drank at one in the village, the same one the other miners who'd gone into work drank in. The Arnhill Arms. The miners who'd downed tools drank in the Bull. The Running Fox was the only place that was kind of neutral ground. None of the miners drank in there. But I knew some of the older kids did, safe in the knowledge that they wouldn't run into their dad or their granddad. My parents weren't bad parents. They loved us as much as they could. If they argued and didn't always have much time for us, it wasn't because they didn't care, but simply because they worked hard and had little spare cash and were often tired. Of course, we had a TV and a cassette player and a computer, but still, without wanting to sound like a Hovis ad, a lot of the time we made our own entertainment. I'd play tag and footy with Annie in the street. We'd draw chalk pictures on the pavement or play cards to while away rainy afternoons. I never resented entertaining my little sister. I enjoyed spending time with her. If the weather was good, or at least not chucking it down, Mum would think nothing of shooing me and Annie out of the house on a Saturday morning with a bit of money in our pockets to buy some tuck, and not expect to see us back until tea time. Mostly it was a good thing. We had freedom. We had our imagination, and we had each other. As I hit my late teens, things changed. I found myself with a new group of mates. Stephen Hurst and his gang. A rough group of kids that an awkward misfit like me had no place being friends with. Perhaps Hurst mistook my outsider status for being tough. Perhaps he just saw a kid he could easily manipulate. Whatever the reason, I was stupidly grateful to be part of his gang. I'd never had a problem with being a loner before, but a taste of social acceptance can be intoxicating for a teenager who was never invited to the party. We hung around and did the usual things gangs of teenage boys do. We swore, smoked, and drank. We graffitied the playground and tangled the swings over the top of the bars. We egged the houses of teachers we didn't like and slashed the tires of those we really hated. And we bullied. We tormented kids feebler than us. Kids who were, I tried not to admit, just like me. Suddenly, hanging out with my 8-year-old sister was not cool. It was mortally embarrassing. When Annie asked to come down the shop with me, I'd make excuses or leave before she saw me go. If I was out with my new gang, I'd turn away when she waved. I tried not to notice the hurt in her eyes or the way her face fell. At home, I worked doubly hard to make it up to her. She knew I was overcompensating. Kids aren't stupid. But she let me, and that made me feel worse. The stupid thing is, looking back, I was always happier hanging out with Annie than with anyone else. Trying to act hard isn't the same as being hard. I wish I could tell my 15-year-old self that, along with a shitload of other things. Girls don't actually go for the quiet ones. Numbing your ear with an ice cube to pierce it doesn't work. And Thunderbird is not a wine, nor a suitable drink to consume before a wedding reception. Mostly, I wish I could tell my sister that I loved her. More than anything. She was my best friend, the person I could truly be myself with, and the only one who could make me laugh until I cried. But I can't. Because when my sister was 8 years old, she disappeared. At the time, I thought it was the worst thing in the world that could ever happen. And then she came back. 4. I'd prepare for my first day at Arnhill Academy in my usual way. I drink too much the night before, wake late, curse at the alarm, and then reluctantly and resentfully limp across the landing into the bathroom. I turn the shower over the bath to max, which elicits a half-hearted trickle of water. Then clamber in and catch a few spurts of warmth before struggling out again, toweling myself dry, and pulling on some clean clothes. I choose a black shirt, dark blue jeans, and my tattered old Converse. There's a first day smart, and there's being in your boogie shoes. Stupid phrase, I know. I picked it up from Brendan, my old flatmate. Brendan is Irish. That means he has any number of sayings for any given situation. Most make absolutely no sense whatsoever, but that one I always understood. Everyone has a pair of boogie shoes. The ones they sling on when they want to feel comfortable and at ease. Some days you need them more than others. I drag a comb through my hair and leave it to dry as I head downstairs for a black coffee and a cigarette. I smoke it lurking just outside the open back door. It's only marginally colder outside than in. The sky is a hard slab of grey concrete, and a faint, mean drizzle spits in my face. If the sun has got his hat on, it's definitely a rain hat. I reach the school gates just before 8:30, along with the first dribble of pupils. A trio of girls, tapping away on smartphones and flicking their rigorously straightened hair. A group of boys pushing and shoving in the jokey way that can turn into a genuine fight in the blink of an eye. A couple of emo kids with heavy fringes from under which to glower at figures of authority. And then there are the solitary arrivals. The ones who walk with their heads down and their shoulders hunched. The slow, ragged walk of the condemned. The bullied. I pick out one girl, short, with frizzy red hair, bad skin and an ill-fitting uniform. She reminds me of a pupil from my own school days. Ruth Moore. She always smelled a little of B.O., and no one ever wanted to sit next to her in class. The other kids used to make up rhymes about her. Ruth Moore, she's so poor, gets free meals and begs for more. Ruth Moore, ugly and poor, licks up shit from the toilet floor. Funny how creative kids can be when they're being cruel. Not far behind, I spot victim number two. Tall and skinny, with a shock of dark hair standing up almost vertically from his head. He wears glasses and walks with a stoop, partly because of his height, partly because of the heavy rucksack slung over his back. I bet he's rubbish at football, and all the sports. But on his PlayStation, he's a king among geeks. I feel a personal stab of recognition. Hey Marcus, you fucking pussy! The cry comes from a group of boys sauntering up the street behind him. Five of them. Year 11, I would guess. They walk towards the skinny boy, with the fluid swagger of a gang. Passive-aggressive. The leader, tall, good-looking, dark hair, slings an arm around skinny boy's shoulders and says something to him. Skinny boy tries to look relaxed, but everything about his posture screams tension and nerves. The rest of the gang forms a loose circle, preventing escape, sealing off his route into the school or away from them. I hang back a little. They haven't seen me yet. I'm on the opposite side of the road, and of course they don't know I'm a teacher. I'm just a scruffy bloke in a duffel coat and Converse. I could continue to be that bloke. It's not officially school hours. We're not even inside the school gates, and it's my first day. There will be other days, other times, to sort out issues like this. I reach into my pocket for my Marlboro lights, and watch as the gang force Skinny Boy against a wall. The nervy smile has fled. He opens his mouth to protest. Leader Boy presses an arm against his throat as one of the gang slips the rucksack from his shoulder, and the rest fall upon it like a pack of feral dogs, pulling out books and textbooks, ripping out pages, stamping on his cling film sandwiches. One of them gleefully extracts what looks like a new iPhone. Why, I think. Why do parents send them off to school with this crap? At least in my day, the worst thing a bully could steal would be your lunch money or your favourite comic. I look longingly at my cigarettes. Then, with a sigh, I slip them back in my pocket and walk across the road towards the altercation. Skinny boy tries to grab his phone back